Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the fabulous fireside room, the speaker is David Lund, and he will be speaking on Jew hatred, past and present. So, let's listen in on David.
The nine questions people ask about Judaism, it was mainly written for non-observant Jews, or secular Jews, to think about their own, observance or non-observance, but it's also a great introduction to non-Jews about Judaism, and because it really gets at the heart of many of the tough issues in Judaism and in North America today and in relationships between Jews and non-Jews. This book is called Why the Jews, the Reasons for Anti-Semitism. It's in paperback in the bookstore, and it relates most directly to what we're going to be talking about today. Have any of you looked into either of these books and read anything at all? If you do, you'll find out that I'm indebted to them a lot in a lot of the presentation that I make. I don't present anything original. I just steal from other people, and I freely admit it, even if I can't remember who I've stolen from. I'm like Chuck, who says he's a confessed collaborator. I work together with people, and I'm not ashamed of it. And I'm actually quite well acquainted with Dennis Prager, who lives in Los Angeles. He's a radio host and a writer. And Joseph Telushkin is a conservative rabbi in L.A. So, two very good books, very well written, short, concise. You guys want an outline? So anyway, I recommend them to you. Especially if you are in any way related to Jews or or in any of your family relationships, or you want to learn more about the religion of a friend of yours, this is great. The nine questions is really the best introduction you can find. And it really gets at the real gnarly issues. All right, today we're going to talk about Jew hatred. And you might have wondered why I say that, Jew hatred. Why do I call it Jew hatred? You'll find out why in a minute. Anti-Semitism is the euphemism for Jew hatred, for hatred of Jews. And I'll talk about it in a little bit. I'd like to start out by reading to you a little bit out of the introduction here. And you get a picture of what's at stake. Hatred of Jews has been humanity's greatest hatred. While hatred of other groups has always existed, no hatred has been as universal, as deep, or as permanent as anti-Semitism. Jews have been objects of hatred in pagan, religious, and secular societies. Fascists have accused them of being communists. Communists have branded them capitalists. Jews who live in non-Jewish societies have been accused of having dual loyalties. And Jews who live in the Jewish state have been condemned as racists. Poor Jews are bullied and rich Jews are resented. Jews have been branded as both rootless cosmopolitans and ethnic chauvinists. Jews who assimilate are often called the fifth column, while those who stay together often spark hatred for remaining different. Literally, hundreds of millions of people have believed that Jews drink the blood of non-Jews, that they cause plagues and poison wells, and that they plan to conquer the world, and that they murdered God himself. The universality of anti-Semitism is attested to by innumerable facts, the most dramatic being that Jews have been expelled from virtually every country in which they have resided. Jews were expelled from England, France, Hungary, Austria, Germany, Lithuania, Spain, Portugal, Bohemia, Moravia, Russia, and other places. The depth of anti-Semitism is evidenced by the frequency with which hostility against Jews has gone far beyond discrimination and erupted into sustained violence. In nearly every country where Jews have lived, they have at some time been subjected to beatings, torture, and murder solely because they were Jews. In the Russian Empire during the 19th and 20th centuries, if you didn't start the tape, you can do so. I'm sorry. Mass beatings and murders of Jews were so common that a word, pogrom, was coined to describe such incidents. And these pogroms were viewed by their anti-Semitic perpetrators as being of such significance that they were equated with the salvation of Russia. On a number of occasions, even beating and murdering Jewish communities were not deemed sufficient. anti-Semitic passions have run so deep that only the actual annihilation of the Jewish people could solve what came to be called the Jewish problem. The basic source of ancient Jewish history, the Bible, depicts two attempts to destroy the Jewish people. The attempt by Pharaoh and the Egyptians in Exodus, and that of Haman and the Persians in the book of Esther. While it is true that the historicity of these biblical accounts has not been proven or disproven, few would dispute the supposition that in ancient times attempts were made to destroy the Jews. On two occasions in the last 350 years, annihilation campaigns have been waged against the Jews. The Khmelnytsky massacres in Eastern Europe in 1648 and 1649, and the Nazi destruction of Jews throughout Europe between 1939 and 1945. For various reasons, the Khmelnytsky massacres are today not well known among Jews and virtually unknown among non-Jews. Perhaps the Holocaust tends to overshadow all previous Jewish sufferings. Yet, without denying the unique aspects of the Nazi Holocaust, we are obliged to cite a number of significant similarities between it and the Khmelnytsky massacres. In both instances, all Jews, including infants, were targeted for murder. The general populaces nearly always joined in the attacks. And the torture and degradation of Jews were an integral part of the murderers' procedures. These characteristics are evidenced by the following contemporaneous description of a typical Khmelnytsky massacre. Remember, this is 1648, mostly in Poland. Some of them had their skins flayed off, and their flesh was flung to animals. The hands and feet of others were cut off, and they were flung onto the roadway where carts ran over them. Many were buried alive. Children were slaughtered in their mothers' bosoms, and many children were torn apart like fish. They ripped up the bellies of pregnant women, took out unborn children, and flung them in their faces. They tore open the bellies of some and placed a living cat within the belly and left them alive thus, cutting off their hands so they should not be able to remove it. And there was never an unnatural death in the world that they did not inflict upon them. 1648. The permanence of anti-Semitism is attested to by the obsessive attention given to the Jewish problem by anti-Semites throughout history. At one time or another, nearly every one of the world's greatest powers that has had a large Jewish population has regarded this group, which never constituted more than a small percentage of the population, as an enemy. To the Roman Empire, the Christian world for over 15 centuries, the Nazi Reich, And to the Arabs, Muslims, and the Soviet Union, in more recent times, the Jews have been regarded as an insufferable threat. Jews have been perceived as so dangerous that even after their expulsion or destruction, hatred and fear of them remain. The depiction of Jews as ritual murderers of young Christian children in the Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, 100 years after all Jews had been expelled from England, attest to the durability of anti-Semitism. So I hope that sentence is kind of funny. You get that? 100 years after all Jews were expelled from England, Chaucer wrote his stuff in the Canterbury Tales about the ritual murder of young Christian children. All right. I'm going to finish this. The question that we're asking is this. Ancient Egyptians, Greeks, Romans, medieval, and many modern Christians and Muslims, Nazis, and communists have perhaps only one thing in common. They have all counted the Jews as their enemy, often their greatest enemy. Why? This question has been posed only by modern Jews. From the recorded beginnings of Jewish history until the modern age, Jews never asked, why the Jews? They knew exactly why. Throughout their history, Jews have regarded Jew hatred as an inevitable consequence of their Jewishness. Contrary to modern understandings of anti-Semitism, the age-old Jewish understanding of anti-Semitism does posit a universal reason for Jew hatred, Judaism. So, now you know what my goal is in this session today, is to persuade you that the many sort of marginal reasons that people think Jews are hated are usually very marginal and not accurate at all. And the real reason for anti-Semitism is Judaism. The faith of Israel and Israel's way of life. That's my thesis. At the end, you can tell me if I've succeeded. So, if you'd like to follow along in the outline, I'll proceed in giving you information and then we'll have time to discuss. You notice it everywhere.
Do you have other outlines?
I don't have any more, so if you could share with somebody. Even in modern liberal North America, people don't use the word Jew. They always say Jewish person. People often come up to me and say, well, I have a son or a daughter. I have a daughter who married a Jewish guy. Why not say, I have a daughter who married a Jew? Why is that? Even the term is avoided. Even in societies that are not terribly anti-Semitic, like modern America. Why is that? Well, it's a term laden with emotion. It's a term that arouses passions. Why is that? Why is it that people never react sort of neutrally or with no emotion to the word Jew and the idea of the Jew?
I thought that was a put down. I did too.
And so
maybe they were offended by it.
It's
only a
put. I mean, it can't be used derogatorily, so people are.
But that's exactly what my response would be. It's a put down in the mouth of anti-Semites.
Right.
Well, in the same hand, you would say my daughter married a Jew man. That's English is not correct.
What?
I mean, grammatically, that's not correct.
A Jew.
Married a Jew. Well, I guess you could say that. Yeah.
It's a derogatory term in the mouth of anti-Semites. You see. And that's why it's gotten to have that connotation.
Well, I think you think about the Holocaust and you think about, I mean, all the books that I've read about the Holocaust and how it was so negatively used by the Nazis.
You bet.
And so it feels like you shouldn't use it.
Don't be misunderstood.
Yeah.
Fair enough. But again, when you talk about Norwegian, you say a Norwegian, a Swede.
Lots of times people don't like to be referred to as their ethnic origin. I'm American. I'm not Japanese.
Fair enough. But you see the point. It's a term. The term itself, it's actually correct. I mean, to say Jewish person, we don't say Norwegian person or Irish person. It puts, by definition, it's putting Jews in a separate category. Or just by the use of language. So, why is that? Well, somehow, especially for Christians and Muslims, we must react somehow. Because Jews are very close kin. The Christian and the Muslim faith have roots in Judaism. But it is interesting because people, for example, don't react the same way at the word Muslim, even though there are billions of them, compared with 13 million Jews today. There's some other things that we need to talk about. There's a language confusion. And we talked about this the first time, but I'll just briefly remind you. The term Jew means a person born to Jewish parents. Some people prefer the term born Jew. It also means a person who believes and practices Judaism from any ethnic group. Any convert is a Jew, regardless of where they were born or what their ethnic origin is. So Jews are not a race in the usual sense. Other kinds of races, you can't join it. But you can become Jewish. You can become a Jew if you were born an African or a Norwegian or a Malaysian. And in most times and places, Jews who converted or assimilated were not seen as Jews. So in the Middle Ages, Jews that were baptized and became Christians were no longer seen as Jews. And that's been universally true. Except, with one exception, and that is the Holocaust. The Nazis created something utterly unique and utterly new. The fact that Jews would be persecuted based on how they were born, you know, whether they were born Jewish or not. So in other words, Jews in Germany who were Christians, who were Lutherans, were sent to the camps and were persecuted just as much as an observant religious Jew in a synagogue. But that was new. You need to understand, that was new. So basically what I'm arguing is, Jews were persecuted for their religion and their adherence to it. Because the minute they abandoned it and became Christian or just became secular or lost their Jewish religious identity, were no longer seen as Jews. Except for the Nazis. The Nazis had a racial ideology that said being Jewish is in your blood, not in your religion. But that was new. Okay, imagine the ancient Near East. Imagine the world that Israel emerged into with all of the people around it, with all of the religions and the empires and the armies and everything. And along comes this small people and says, all that you worship and hold holy is nothing, is drivel. And imagine that that small people says, there is only one God, and that God is the universal God, is the God over everyone, including you. And then that small people says, God cannot be seen. God is an invisible, non-material, transcendent God. Not part of the creation, outside of the creation. And then finally, that small people says, and this true God has introduced himself to us and revealed God's will to us. What are the neighbors going to say? Who do you think you are? Who do you think you are? Saying that all our gods and all our holy places are nothing. Everything that we hold dear. You see, all the nations around Israel had lots of gods and goddesses, but they were national gods. They were tied to that nation. Every nation had their gods. That's your nation, those are your gods. And along comes Israel and says, yes, this is our God, but it is your God too. This is the only God. There's only one God. You see how radical monotheism is? One God? Universal God? Of all people? Of all creation? Another way of putting it is, if you are one of Israel's neighbors, let's say you're Greek, you're living in the Greek times or the Roman times, would you rather accept many difficult ethical laws from an invisible God who will punish you if you violate them? Or would you rather have an orgy? And just, would you rather live out all of your appetites? Would you rather live out all of your desires? All your desires for, you know, appetites, for food, sex, whatever, enjoyment, pleasure. What would you rather do? That's what people, that's how people have responded to Israel. That's how people have responded to the Jews. They said, wait a minute. You know, the Greeks are saying, hold it. You're saying I should only have sex with a woman and only with one woman? And never with anyone else? I mean, the Greeks thought it was insane. They never heard of such a thing. I should restrict my pleasures? You know, for the sake of some invisible moral God? Excuse me? You see? All right. And by the way, this is exactly how the people of Israel responded at the foot of the mountain. Moses came down with some commandments, and what did they do? They had an orgy. Golden calf. You know, let us live out our desires. So it seems to be a very natural human thing to want to live out his human desires and appetites. And even Israel at first reacted that way to the idea of an invisible, unknowable God who gives commandments and who asks people to shape their life in ways that restrain their desires and appetites. Okay, number five. The reason it's not just to be catchy, the reason I use the term Jew hatred is because that is really what we're talking about. The term anti-Semitism was invented in 1879, didn't exist before then, by a German named Wilhelm Marr. He was an academic, and he was a Jew hater. And he decided that the term Judenhass, Jew hatred, was kind of vulgar. It just sounded, you know, he was a sort of a rational, enlightened, civilized German, and he thought Judenhass sounded too bad. So he invented a term, he coined a term that sounded less vulgar and that sounded somewhat scientific. So he invented the term anti-Semitism, antisemitismus. That's why it was invented, to sort of make Jew hatred seem a little more polite.
Academic.
The term itself is very misleading. It's actually an absurd term, because who are Semites? Almost all Middle Eastern peoples. I mean, to talk about Arabs being anti-Semitic is kind of funny, because that mean they hate themselves. You see, I mean, Semitic peoples include most of the Arab world. So it's not even accurate on its own terms. And we use the term, I'm not advocating using the term Jew hatred, okay? I just want to make the point so you understand. We're not going to stop using the word anti-Semitic, because it is more polite, and it's just comes more naturally in polite conversation. But I want you to understand what it is. It's a euphemism that was created by a Jew hater to make it sound more urbane. All right. People believe several false reasons for Jew hatred. The first one is the scapegoat theory. This is the idea that Hitler and any other societies who have persecuted Jews have needed a scapegoat for their problems. Economic problems, blah, 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 blah. Well, this is really a false theory, because if Hitler came to power and then labeled the Jews as his scapegoat, that would be one thing, but he didn't. Hitler got into power so he could persecute and remove Jews. Hitler wanted to get into power because he was a Jew hater. You see, that was his original intention in the first place. The scapegoat theory only explains when, why, and how people use anti-Semitism, not why they're anti-Semitic. In other words, it explains Hitler's method in persecuting Jews. He used the excuse, he used the propaganda of scapegoat type rhetoric and ideology. But it doesn't explain why he hated Jews. He hated Jews before he decided what method he was going to use to exterminate them. You understand what you see the point? It doesn't explain why people are anti-Semitic in the first place. Okay, the second false reason that many, many people believe is the economics. People hate Jews because they're wealthy. This also is untrue. People hated Jews and murdered them in pogroms when they were poor peasants. In the Middle Ages, most Jews were peasants. They didn't have any financial power at all. In fact, they had to go to cities. You see in Fiddler on the Roof, they have to leave the village and they have to go to a city. Jews went to cities because their land was taken away from them. And they entered financial type careers because they were not allowed to own property. So, you see how it is? You know, and that's, of course, a standard Jew-hater line. You know, Jews are bankers. You know, they're money lenders. And then they're hated because of that. Well, the reason that they became that is because they were hated and forbidden to own property. And they had to make a living somehow. You see? That's why many Jews had to enter those kind of fields. Okay. Jews became money lenders because they were hated. And the other thing that really shows you how false this economic theory is, that the wealthiest Jews ever are in America, where there's the least Jew hatred anywhere since thousands of years. All right. The Khmelnytsky pogroms that I read to you about from 1648, Jews were very poor. They were very agricultural people at that time in that part of the world. Okay, there's another theory that many people believe, and that's what I call the psychological theory. Jew haters are sick and psychologically abnormal somehow. The Holocaust happened because the murderers were sick or because they were fascists, not because the victims were Jews. It's an interesting argument to focus on the Holocaust and focus on the perpetrators and try to explain the Holocaust and ignore the victims. See, there's subtle anti-Semitism even in there. When you look at the Holocaust and you theorize about why it happened and you just completely ignore the victims and their beliefs, their way of life, who they were. You're focusing on Hitler and the SS or something. Well, I don't know about this one, but I am persuaded that this is also rather false. Tens of millions of people cooperated in the Holocaust. I read to you, the largest pogroms have always involved the massive support of the populace, whether in Poland, Germany, France. Tens of millions of people all mentally ill? Tens of millions of people all psychologically sick? In Germany, in the Soviet Union, in the Arab world today? I mean, are tens of millions of Arabs all sick?
Were they brainwashed by their leaders, therefore they could be turned sick in mind?
No. Their leaders expressed openly the popularly held hatred of Jews.
They didn't coerce people?
Nobody in the Einsatzgruppen was coerced. They all volunteered. The Einsatzgruppen was the first groups that went into the east, into Poland and Ukraine. And, you know, before there were death camps, and they just dug mass graves and took the Jews out and just mowed them down with machine guns and buried the mass graves. That's the Einsatzgruppen. They were all volunteers. All Einsatzgruppen were volunteers. And most of them were college educated. Many of them were professors and academics. We'll talk about that in a little bit. The Nazi murderers were evil, not sick. Okay, but there are some actual reasons for Jew hatred, as opposed to these false reasons. And of course, the answer is because of Judaism. The first reason Jews are hated is because of the chosen people idea. Israel is the chosen people to bring God to the world. Abraham was promised land, offspring, and a mission to bring knowledge and faith in the true God to the world. That's what Israel was called for. Not because they're any better. In fact, all over the Bible, you know, God constantly says, it's not because you're a wonderful people that I've chosen you. In fact, you're a rather stiff-necked crowd. You know, I wish you were a little more obedient. That's not why they were chosen. They were chosen to be given a task. Not because they were any better. And I guess the proof of this for me, and maybe for you, is simply that this Israel has survived for 4,000 years. In spite of horrors, in spite of unfaithful Jews, there's no other people in the world that has existed continuously for 4,000 years. And there is certainly no other people in the history of the earth that has survived almost 2,000 years without being in their own land. Think about that. If Norwegians all had to leave their land was conquered and they had to go live, do you think Norwegianness would last 2,000 years? Probably not. Lots of cultures have come and gone, and in fact most cultures, when people are driven off their land, and most cultures just assimilate to the places where they go. But Israel has not. Israel remains a people.
Wouldn't you say that the reason that they survived as a people is adherence to a strict set of their adherence to
Judaism.
Law, to Judaism,
yep.
which is very laid up. And that,
you bet.
And that adherence, which has allowed them to survive, is also which has created the hatred. And if hatred had made them stop adhering, there would no longer be Judaism and it
you bet.
Worked.
You bet.
But we're
going to get to that under C, God and Ethical Monotheism. What are the odds of a bunch of escaped slaves influencing the great majority of people on earth by proclaiming the moral teachings of an invisible, untouchable God? What are the odds of that, people? A small band of escaped... touching the majority of people on the earth. And you'd have to say that wherever Western civilization and Western values touches anybody, that is the way that the Bible's values have reached people. The chances of that are just about nil. Especially such a tiny people. Such a small people. No, Jews aren't born any different. They have changed the world because of Judaism. God used a human tool and uses a human tool to accomplish God's ends. Okay. Now, people also hate Jews because they believe the chosen people idea. You ever think about that? In Japan, the national ideology says that the day in the world begins in Japan, right? The rising sun, it's on the flag. And they believe that in Japanese religious tradition, that they got the sun first from the gods. In other words, Japan is the center of the earth. Now, does anyone hate the Japanese because they think they're the center of the earth? No, because most people don't believe it. In China, the Chinese word for themselves means middle kingdom. And all through Chinese history, they've understood China to be the center of the earth and everyone outside of China to be barbarians. In fact, they call everyone else non-Chinese barbarians. Do people hate the Chinese because of that? No, because most people don't believe it. Even I was given this by a friend of mine who's Native American. He came to a course and he said, you know, it's the same thing with Native American languages. But like, and he's of the Lakota tribe, what used to be called Sioux. And he says, Lakota in the Sioux language means people. And people who aren't Lakota are not people. They're not fully human, really. That's why so many tribes were able to torture and murder non-members of the tribe, just because they're kind of second-class citizens. Has anyone ever hated any Native American tribes because of that? No? Because again, nobody believes it. All right.
Didn't other Native Americans believe that of each other, of other tribes?
No. The enemies of the Lakota didn't believe that the Lakota were human, and they weren't. They didn't believe the Lakota's view of themselves. Just like people don't believe the Japanese view of themselves, or the Chinese view of themselves, outside, on the outside.
You're suggesting that people believe Jews use themselves?
As the chosen people?
Yes, people have believed that Jews are somehow chosen, and are somehow a people set apart. That's why they've been hated. If people didn't believe it, meaning if people didn't believe at all that there was anything to chosenness,
so why do we hate
ignore them?
What difference does it make if God chose them first?
Well, we're getting to that. God and ethical monotheism. Because of the message that... Because of the message that Israel brings.
Why do we hate it? Somebody had to bring it.
Well, you answered the question. What would you rather do? Be confronted with a transcendent, universal God who makes ethical demands, or would you rather live and eat, drink, and be merry?
So we don't like the message.
You bet.
So we kill the messenger.
That's
we
right.
Like to be totally
we don't like the message, so we persecute the messenger.
Okay. Disgusting.
Okay. The second reason is that Israel. The Jewish people is the only transnational nation in the world. In other words, from the year 70 to the year 1948, there was no Jewish state. There was no Jewish kingdom or nation that you could draw on a map. But through all that time, Jews everywhere have acknowledged their highest loyalty to the Jewish people and the nation. And refusal to give the highest loyalty to the state in which they live. For example, it was a big problem in the Napoleonic times. The French were trying to be, you know, liberal and compassionate, but they never allowed Jews to have full citizenship because they realized that Jews' highest loyalty was always to Israel, whatever that meant, and their loyalty to France was always secondary, and would always be secondary. So what happens then in a modern nation state when you got a group of people whose highest loyalty is not to the state? They're unpatriotic. They're not dependable. They're potentially treasonous, yeah.
But that's not true in America today, would you say?
It isn't today, but it has been in America in previous times. Suspected as unpatriotic and so forth. Now, in the past, this was mainly a problem which you might call the right, you know, fascism, extreme conservatism have been suspicious of Jews, and in the Christian world especially, there's been always this intense suspicion of Jewish residents in a country, whether it's been France, Germany, even Scandinavian countries. Today it's changed a lot. Today, well, actually, what I'm going to say is already obsolete, but today the biggest suspicion of Jews as citizens and mistrust had been in the communist world, what you might call the left, you know, in the East Bloc was really the most anti-Semitism because of this issue, and of course in the Islamic world. Jews who live in Islamic countries have a hard time, and increasingly have a hard time, and are increasingly getting out, going to Israel if they can, or coming to America.
And the people, the Islamic people, believe that Jews are the chosen people?
They wouldn't agree to that, and yet their behavior says that they do.
But also...
Because they can't, if they didn't believe it, they would just ignore them, and treat them like any other nation. But they don't.
But the Quran also says, discusses the Jews as the chosen people.
That's right.
And wasn't Muhammad really angry that
yes.
the Jews wouldn't convert
yes.
to Islam? And that sort of...
I mean, Muhammad was a Jew.
Yeah.
Okay. And then he received his revelations, and it seemed to him obvious that all Jews would embrace the way, Islam. And he went to the Jewish community in Medina. And the Jewish community in Medina said politely, thanks, but no thanks. We already know who we are. And that was when Muhammad became very angry and left. And he traveled to Mecca and began an intense... By the way, yeah, that's a good point. It's the exact same thing with Luther's Jew hatred. The treatise by Luther on the Jews and their lies that the ELC last... No, this coming assembly is officially going to repudiate, finally. It's the same thing. I mean, Luther thought that breaking away from the Catholic Church and getting back to the Hebrew Bible, for example, he thought that Jews in Germany then would become Christian. Since the Catholic Church had always been the enemy of the Jews, and now... And it's like the enemy of my enemy is my friend kind of thinking. And Luther thought that same thing. And it's when you know, he came in contact with many Jews who said the same thing, thanks but no thanks, that he became very angry. And that's what he wrote on the Jews and their lives. All right, C. Third reason that people hate Jews is because of God and ethical monotheism. Because of the understanding and the message about God that Israel brought into the world, and because of ethical monotheism. Not only monotheism, the belief in one God, but the belief in one universal God who makes ethical, moral demands on people that are often difficult and involve lots of self-discipline. People don't like that. And of course, in modern times, the most violent Jew hatred ever seen, ever, has been secular, godless Jew hatred on a crusade against religion as a whole. And most people don't think of it this way, but Nazism, in its ideology, was very anti-religious, or at least anti-biblical religion. And of course, Marxism goes without saying. Militantly, especially the Leninist variety, militantly anti-religious. In a rare moment, Hitler said something that was extremely true and accurate that people have kind of forgotten and not been willing to take too seriously. But Hitler said it all when he said, we must get rid of the Jewish God with all... No, the what did he call it? He said, we must get rid of the life-denying Jewish God with all his thou shalt and thou shalt nots. That sums it up. That sums up, I think, at root, the reason that you haters hate Judaism. Because Luther, a little slip there, Hitler expressed it very well. He perceived Judaism as a life-denying religion. In other words, Hitler's ideology was that the Aryan people should be able to live, you know, just, we'd say today, let it all hang out, you know, live these boisterous, vibrant lives. And basically what he meant is living out your natural urges, which in his case was the urge to dominate, to have power over others. Hitler got his ethics from nature. See? Hitler looked at nature. And by the way, this is very much part of the whole philosophical worldview of the 20s and 30s. Hitler looked out at nature and he saw the survival of the fittest. This was when it was Darwin's hatred, you know? He saw the survival of the fittest and he said, look it, the weaker in a species get eaten. They get destroyed. And what does it do? It strengthens the species. It strengthens the group. Well, what was good for animals, Hitler decided was good for people. That the weak should be purged. You know, that if there was weakness in a herd, in a people, the weak should be done away with and not be allowed to reproduce. Therefore, strengthening the race.
The Aryan race.
Yeah. Well, any race. But that was, Hitler said, that's our race. And so, okay. And of course, the Aryan race being the strongest and the other races being weaker makes sense.
I was just going to say, the problem with his theory that ended up being a problem for him was that he didn't understand what real strength was. Mm-hmm. That's what a lot of people's problem is. They think
right.
Strength means power over.
But he got his ethics from nature.
Right.
And by the way, it wasn't just the thing where Aryans are the stronger and the other races are weaker. I mean, weak, sick, retarded Aryans were murdered too. They were a burden. You know, they shouldn't be allowed to live because it weakens the folk, you know, weakens the people.
Have you read Alice Miller's book, For Your Own Good? Because she goes into his background and explains, I think, quite beautifully how he became the monster he did through the abusive treatment of his father. And it's a marvelous book. It's kind of chilling, but marvelous. Mm-hmm. But it shows how the very fundamental issue of child abuse and violence creates these worldviews that...
But it was deeper than his own personal experience. There was a whole philosophical foundation based on nature. Very much a natural ethical system.
The only problem with you saying based on nature is that it makes as if there's only one lesson in nature, which is the Darwinist message, and that's the interdependence is a much stronger lesson.
I'm not saying I agree with it. I'm saying that was the prevailing worldview of the 20s and 30s, especially in Germany.
Of nature. And
that was the understanding.
But nature, for you to characterize it as the lessons of nature, as if nature has one lesson.
Okay, let me say, the lessons of nature as they were understood in the 20s
and
30s.
Good. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We can't read back our later knowledge.
Right.
Yeah, we're not so hot on Darwin anymore, but we can't read that back into the time. We're getting kind of far afield here. What the point of bringing all this up is that Hitler perceived in the God of the Bible a God who cared about the weak, a God who cared about the widow, the orphan, the socially weak. And Hitler said, forget it. That's a life-denying God with all his thou shalt and thou shalt nots. And he really got down to the bedrock of what has animated Jew haters always. When the Greeks, when the Syrian Greeks first encountered the Hebrew world, they couldn't believe it. They saw people caring for sick elderly. And they saw people caring for retarded or deformed children. And they called the Hebrews barbarians. Because the Greeks worshiped beauty, And if a child was born deformed or in any way not beautiful, not full, you know, in the full capacity as they understood it, what did they do? They left the child up on the mountain to die of exposure. Or old and infirm people, they just let them starve. They couldn't understand caring for the weak. They just couldn't understand it. And that's pretty much sums up the whole thing about, you know, commandments creating a kind of community where people don't do what comes natural, where they care for the weak. And by the way, if you would have asked Hitler, if you would have said, well, gee, you know, you believe in that the stronger should always, you know, get the weaker. What if I'm stronger than you and I can kill you? You know what Hitler would have said? He would have said, fine. Go ahead. That's the way it should be. But in the meantime, I'm stronger. And as long as I'm stronger, I'm going to do what I need to do. Okay. Well, I want to talk for a minute about this image I put there, Jews as the miner's canary of the world. It's a very important concept, and if you don't remember anything else from this course, please remember this. Jews are the miner's canary of the world. In other words, you know about a miner's canary? Miners took a canary down into the mine. Because when there is even a trace of noxious gases and fumes, a canary will die. So, miners working, they've got a canary. The canary dies, the miners know it's time to get out. You've got to get out, or you will die. You've got to do something about it. Well, in any culture, in all times and places, when Jews begin to be persecuted or murdered, you know that there are noxious moral fumes. And you know that you better do something. You should know anyway. And, you know, I have a couple Jewish friends who say, you know, we really take this as a compliment. And not all Jews would say that after the Holocaust. Many Jews after the Holocaust say, fine, we'd like to just not be part of this anymore. But there's another way of looking at it that says, when Jews begin to be persecuted, you know that there is evil present. Well, that's something. You know, then I would know that what I do and what I believe in does have to do with goodness and fighting evil in the world. And the other part of the miner's canary business is this. Jew haters, when they have begun to murder Jews, never stop with them. Never stop with Jews. And that's true historically. People who have begun to systematically murder Jews have never stopped with Jews. So non-Jews come along the way too. It's kind of like Pastor Niemöller in Germany saying, some of you have heard his little poem or whatever. He said, when they came and took my Jewish neighbors, I didn't do anything. And then when they came and took my Slavic neighbors, I didn't do anything. And then when they came and took my handicapped neighbors, I didn't do anything. And when they came for me, there was no one left to do anything about it. See, Jew haters never stop with Jews. Because it's not just Jews that they hate. It's Judaism. It's the whole biblical worldview that they hate. It's not an accident that in 1943, Hitler and others started to go out to the Wannsee, and they had people, scholars, come, and they started to revive pagan Germanic religious practices, worshiping the gods and goddesses of pagan Germany, Thor and Odin and Freya and all the rest. There's more there than most people realize. An utter rejection of the biblical God. And of course it became clear to the Nazis, especially the thinkers like Goebbels, very early on that, you know, if Jews needed to go because of this, then Christians did too. Because they also worship this God of the weak, God of the helpless, the pathetic. I mean, it just made the Nazis sick to their stomach to think of a God who cared about the weak and the sick and the retarded and etc. Weak members of society, children. They couldn't stand it. So, that's a lot about God and ethical monotheism. Let's go on. Higher quality of Jewish life. Judaism creates, as you'd expect, a higher quality of life in a community. Observance of Torah, as shouldn't surprise you after our second session, issues in better life. Safer, more beautiful, more prosperous life. So the first thing, success in education and high literacy. Well, Judaism is a religion of study. Study is a religious obligation. So people learn to study. They don't only study the Bible, they eventually study other things and excel. They learn to study. So in a culture where you get somewhere by study, Jews are going to get somewhere. Just because, again, it's because of Judaism. Because it's built, it's a whole religion built around study and the obligation to study. That's what Sabbath is about. It's time for study and so forth. Education has always been extremely important in all, in any kind of traditional Judaism. I will give you a quote here from Maimonides, who's the greatest Jewish thinker and scholar in history. He's from the Middle Ages and he lived in Cairo. And he said this: "Every Jew is under an obligation to study Torah, whether he is poor or rich, in sound health or ailing, in the vigor of youth or the very old and feeble." Talk about continuing education, huh? "Even a man so poor that he is maintained by charity or goes begging from door to door, also a man with wife and children to support, are under the obligation to set aside a definite period during the day and night for the study of the Torah. Until what period in life ought one to study Torah? Until the day of one's death." So study as a way of life, literacy, in the development of the intellect, it has ramifications for all other things. Law, medicine, whatever. When education is valued, that's what happens. Okay, family issues. Always in religious Jewish communities, there's been less divorce, more family and community closeness, things like interest-free loans. Judaism is a faith centered on home and community. The movie A Stranger Among Us, if you haven't seen it, you should, where an undercover cop in New York has to go and live with the Hasidim to try to clear up a murder. It's a fantastic film. But one of the things that was so stunning is how she can't believe that they don't have any contracts among each other. And they say, "No, we just shake hands and we agree." And she says, "Well, aren't you afraid that you get ripped off, you know, with no written contract?" And they said, "No, no member of our community has ever cheated anyone else. It's not a problem. We're not worried about it." So the sense of, communal solidarity and help. And again, when people encounter community with family closeness, with low divorce rate, with a very healthy community, most people's reaction is not, "Wow, tell me about it. How do you do this?" And most people's reaction is what?
Get a little
envy, resentment. It even works on a personal level. I mean, when you encounter someone who just seems to be so fulfilled and happy, what is often your reaction? Are you just happy with them all the time?
Envy,
jealousy. And what works on an individual level works on a group level too. That's also a real reason for Jew hatred. Also, the emphasis on charity. Tzedakah in Hebrew, actually, that doesn't mean charity, it means justice. It's an obligation. I don't like the word charity to translate it, because charity in English implies sort of voluntary giving. But tzedakah is not voluntary, it's a religious obligation. And therefore, Jewish poverty is extremely rare. It's extremely rare that Jews have lived in poverty because of their religious obligation to give the tithe, and then it's distributed, and the weak are cared for. And the people who are... Jews are very rarely dependent on public funds in any country. There are almost no beggars among Jews. So this makes Jews seem wealthier even when they're not, because they're not poor and they're not in poverty. But it's because of the communal commitment to one another. There's a time in the 18th century when one half of the Jews in the city of London supported the other half. See, what it's a constant refrain of Jew haters is this: the Jews only take care of their own. Mm-hmm. You heard that probably. Yeah, the Jews only take care of their own. But in reality, the fact is, only the Jews take care of their own. If every group of people in the world took care of one another the way that Jews take care of one another, we live in a semi-paradise. Mm-hmm. We would.
Isn't that a little bit true of the black people kind of fight each other if they do something like the Jewish people support each other?
Well, I don't know any other group that supports each other. How about Christians? How about Americans in general?
But you lump all the blacks in one group, and that's not true. There's many groups of them.
No, it's not true, and yet there is no group that has that kind of communal solidarity. None. I have a friend who does a lot of fundraising for Jews in trouble. Fundraising for Jews in what once was the Soviet Union today, fundraising for Jews in Russia to try to help them, get them out. And he once, somebody came up after a talk and said, you know, I'm an Afghani. You know, and my people are in trouble in Afghanistan. How come you Jews are always working to help, you know, Jews, and you don't seem to care about anyone else? And my friend said, what are you doing on behalf of Afghanis? What's the Afghani community doing to help people in Afghanistan? See? And that man walked away with a real, really changed in his whole thinking. He went in with this anti-Semitic kind of thing. You Jews, you only seem to take care of one another. Why not, you know, why don't you care about anybody else? But then when my friend turned the question around and said, well, what are you doing for your people? We're doing what we need to do for our people. What are you doing for your people? If every people did what they could do for their own, the world would be a real different kind of place. You see? So, again, people don't look at the Jewish model and then say, wow, what could we learn from that? How could we learn something from that and do that? People don't do that. They react negatively. They say, the Jews are selfish. You see, rather than being open to learning something.
There's a sense of that even with the Mormons.
Mormons are much more into that communal caring for one another than most groups. But they're hated because of it. That's right. So that's a real reason for murder rates, domestic violence rates. Rates of alcohol abuse are all lower in religious Jewish communities than in the general population. And again, higher quality of life. People don't go, hey, to teach us how to do it. You know, or, you know, they react negatively with resentment, envy, hatred.
Did some of that come from necessity, though, because they knew they weren't ready to help anyone else?
Well, it's like, what came first, the chicken or the egg? Did it come out of necessity because they didn't get help, or did they not get help because they were different?
Isn't it biblical, though? I mean, all of what they're practicing is
course.
All it's biblical.
Of course. Absolutely.
All of them.
Okay. Now, the last thing I want to talk about is anti-Zionism. There are people who say, I'm not anti-Semitic. I don't have anything against Jews, but I'm an anti-Zionist. Now, let's get clear on the definition. To be severely critical of certain Israeli policies is not anti-Zionism. An anti-Zionist is one who denies Israel's right to exist as the Jewish state. That is an anti-Zionist. If you are massively critical of some policies of the Israeli government, but you basically affirm Israel's right to exist there as a state, you're not an anti-Zionist. No matter how much you might disagree with some particular policy regarding the occupied territories or whatever. An anti-Zionist is a person who denies Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state. Now, there are fewer today than there have been at different times, but there's still many anti-Zionists. If one supports efforts to destroy the Jewish state, one can only be called an anti-Semite, since nearly every Jew has a sense of national identity and supports Israel.